Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Some big games are a bit of a damp squib, and then other big games have one team's £100 million striker saying he'd basically rather not have joined the club 2 days beforehand, an Irishman drafted in at late notice to play a crucial role, at least two goal of the month contenders inside the first 40 minutes, and a possible red card inside 6 seconds. Yeah, I think it's fair to say Chelsea-Liverpool delivered in spades. All right, hello and welcome to today's Second Half Football Podcast. Hello there, Ken.
Hello, Kieran, how are you?
I'm good. And that's before we even get to Man City's 2-1 win on Saturday morning and the league-wide conspiracy against Arsenal that goes right to the very top of British society, apparently. So it was a very dramatic week to start off 2022. And we should start off 2022 by wishing you all a very happy new year. Thanks so much for all your support in 2021. And hopefully you'll stick with us for another year of shows this year. A very good weekend for Queevy and Kelleher as well. Ken, am I a sentimental old goat, or is it not very nice to see an Irish player playing and distinguishing himself in a game of this magnitude, even if it's an Irish player who can't currently get into the Irish team?
Well, that's the problem with our uneven distribution of talent. Why are our best players all goalkeepers? It's a cruel one. I mean, at least, you know, when they were all fullbacks, you could fit two of them in the team.
But and play two of them as wingers, which we definitely did for a while.
Unless, you know, Bazunu plays in midfield at some point.
I think Kelleher is a better option in midfield. I like the way he stops completely. He stands stock still while
waiting for a player to rush at him and then just
it's unbelievable. This is the sort of composure we need in the middle of the park.
A couple of times I was watching that, it's like, get rid of it. No, but he's been through those psychological barriers. I mean, he did lob a couple of poor passes into the sort of the line separating Liverpool's defensive third from the middle third, I thought, to straight to opponent. That happened once or twice, and I was though he gets every pass right. Did you see his number one fan Virgil van Dijk talking about him after the game?
I sure did.
And his presence is good. He's confident on the ball.
The relevant section, I thought. I mean, he was praising young Quibin, in every aspect. But do you think there was anything pointed in the fact that Van Dijk said, he couldn't do anything about the first goal? I thought there was a little bit of, the first goal was a great strike.
I thought the second goal was a pretty good finish as well, to be fair. I mean, are we blaming him for that? Come on, Virgil.
Well, Virgil was having the finger pointed at him by a lot of people.
Yes.
Well, what's the story with this guy? You know, he used to run. He used to run once. You know, this guy used to, the time was when he'd be across. Actually, come think of it, the most acclaimed piece, individual instance of defending by Virgil van Dijk since he joined Liverpool. Can you, do, is there a candidate in mind?
I'm going to say, there was a blatant 2-on-1. I think it was I think it was Spurs.
I think Spurs.
Son was the guy that he was that. Son was the guy who didn't have the ball. The guy who did have the ball was Moussa Sissoko.
That's exactly, you remembered it exactly right.
God, 2022 is going to be a hell of a year. If that's how we've started.
You are ahead of the game.
But that's what Van Dijk did. Now this is it was a slightly different situation from the Chelsea second goal yesterday. But his the everybody heaped praise on him for showing patience and faith in his goalkeeper. And deciding to cover the pass to Son, who he obviously decided was the more dangerous of the two finishers who were bearing down on his goal, and leaving Sissoko to have a go on his left foot. And that's kind of what he did as well with Pulisic, because if he had gone, as everybody was suggesting he should have done, and sort of sprinted and sort of thrown himself across the path of Pulisic, not only does he open himself up to maybe Pulisic just cutting inside him and scoring on his right foot, but there's the option of Pulisic just laying it into the space that he's left behind. I think it was Mason Mount who has now a clear shot and goal. So that may be why he didn't move. Maybe he expected Kelleher to close down Pulisic a little bit more. I did think Pulisic, though, took it really early and just, you know, put it away really well. You know, it was a better finisher. It was a better finish from the way that he had to sort of control the ball. It was slightly awkward, and it was on his left side, and he pulled out a better finish than I'd have expected him to. So maybe Virgil was thinking, okay, you know, I've sized up all the probabilities here, and, you know, I'm going to put my faith in Queeveen, and oh no. Well, he couldn't do anything about the first goal. Or maybe it's simply that Virgil just doesn't run that much anymore. He's just not, you know, yeah. We still haven't really seen enough of his defending since that massive injury he had. But it was an interesting comment from him about Queeveen.
We'll be speaking to Rafa Honigstein in just a few minutes about Tuchel versus Lukaku, and also if City are starting to look more and more like an English Bayern Munich. But first, let's report on some sport there, please, Ken.
So, I mean, it was a great weekend. I mean, I was watching the Goal of the Month contest.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw recently, I can't remember in what context, but like the legendary December 2006 Goal of the Month competition, which has, you know, like Michael Essien's crazy goal against Arsenal. I think that was the winner. But like a load of...
Scholes' volley off the bar against Villa.
I think that was the goal of the month tournament. Maybe Drogba scored a great goal against Everton that month. There was a lot of this, you know, crashing, smashing goals. It's regarded as a classic. And I was just thinking, you know, nobody was really saying this about the December 2021 Goal of the Month, but I thought, like, there's a lot of stuff in there that would just wipe the floor with this 2006. Or, like, a lot of the 2006 goals suddenly look just quite standard.
Yeah, the first three goals of the... I mean, it's been a while since we've talked about the Goal of the Month.
I know.
But I will say this, the first three were all unbelievable volleys. Like, the first three were volleys.
Bernardo Silva,
Mason Mount against West Ham, which is a very difficult technical volley, I thought.
And Mope.
Yes, that was an overhead. And then the next three were like just crashing drives from outside the area.
Lucas Moura, Trent Alexander-Arnold, and Kevin De Bruyne.
And then there, for a little something different, there was Alexandre Lacazette's goal that started with Ramsdale.
A rhythmic passing build-up from Arsenal. Yeah. From one of the
there was something for everyone, Ken. There was no doubt about it.
There really was. You know, I thought both Lucas Moura and Bernardo Silva were a little hard done by.
Oh, I actually didn't watch to the end to find out who won.
Oh, who do you think won?
Who do you think won then?
This is, you know, we can... what's this called? A Keynesian beauty contest? Which goal did you think is most beautiful, but which goal do you think won the popularity contest?
Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Correct. And can you show your workings? Why do you think it was
Trent? Because Liverpool fans will vote in far greater numbers than any other fans. Let's say Kevin De Bruyne didn't have much of it, or Bernardo. So, well, maybe the Man City vote was split.
And it split the vote, of course.
Maybe
that's
what happened.
And that's why only one of them made it into the top three. But Lucas Moura was the other one that made it into the top three. But yes, you are correct. Trent Alexander-Arnold did win. And that was the same reason that I thought. But just over the weekend that happened, there were some unbelievable goals. Like Lanzini,
yeah,
for West Ham, where he just took like a load of touches without the ball touching the ground and smashed it in.
In off the crossbar as well. And I have to say, you know, a goal is improved by 10 to 15% if there's a little in off the underside of the crossbar going on as well.
But the Alexis McAllister goal number two against Everton was absolutely incredible. Mm. And he then comes out in his interview afterwards and says, well, the first one was better.
Yeah, well.
The first goal was clearly better. And I'm like, No, you're wrong.
I respect you, but you're wrong.
You have a lot to learn about English football, and definitely your second goal was better. Just the sheer amount of welly involved in this. Johan Wiese's goal for Brentford, Salah and Kovacic, obviously in the game that was on last night. You know, Saka, Stuart Dallas, another Cookstown curler.
Cookstown sizzler from Stuarty Dallas. Unbelievable.
Even Danny Ings in that game.
Yeah, brilliant goal.
That was a lovely goal. So, I mean, you know, what can I do? Like, I'm just a whirlwind of positivity here, just saying, that was a great goal. And that was a great goal. And another thing, celebrating in front of opposing fans. I remember Arsenal were told earlier in the season not to do it at Leeds. Remember they were doing this, they were kind of celebrating, and the referee kind of said, oh, get out of there, stop doing this. Did it happen again more recently? Did a referee said, oh, here, listen, stop that. Did anyone say anything to Rodri for what he did at the end? I honestly thought, Rodri, like, have you been following what's been going on here? Or, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've got like an earpiece of the Steve McManaman BT Sport commentary and are experiencing a totally different version of the game from like most of the people in that stadium, and I believe most of the people watching on television, who, you know, I mean, I don't know if you were watching the game, Kieran, but was it that the commentary was particularly bad, or was it simply that I was hungover? I wasn't sure. I mean, it was the first game of
I think there's Newsday. I think there's also just like people are reaching their breaking point with BT's just non-stop obsession with refereeing decisions and VAR. Just on every single game that they cover, it's just a non-stop. Like, we hate to talk about VAR. We hate to talk about refereeing decisions, but I'm afraid we must.
Well,
for 25
I'm afraid
minutes.
We must, though. We actually must. I'm afraid that we must. I'm sorry. It's just, well, I thought they were kind of just missing what was going on. I mean, it just seemed to me again, it was a similar story to the Tottenham.
What decisions did the referee and VAR get wrong in the Manchester City-Arsenal game on Saturday morning, Ken?
A blatant foul by Ederson missed and not even reviewed. Mm. It's a blatant foul. It's not even
I think.
It's not
I
even
think
debate.
There's an argument that there's a couple of camera angles which suggest that he may have got a foot on the ball. And if he gets a foot
there
on the
is
ball,
a,
then...
There is a camera angle in which you can clearly see that he hits Odegaard's foot before... I mean, he does get a touch on the ball, or maybe he drives Odegaard's foot into the ball. But one way or the other, Odegaard's foot is between him and the ball. That's a foul, unquestionably. And when you saw it in real time, it looked every inch a foul. That'll blaze again. That's clearly
a penalty.
I think
if it's given as a penalty, VAR definitely aren't overturning it. But But at the same time, the fact that me and you are disagreeing means that it's possible that...
Well, the fact that we mean you were disagreeing just tells me that
you're
you didn't see it properly. No, seriously, you didn't. You
no,
must have seen it.
Like, I watched it a million times, Ken. I mean, there's no way of avoiding it.
I don't know how you can have failed to see. I mean, it's so clear, you know. And this is the second time that Ederson has got away with like a really blatant foul. I mean, the last time he did, the ball was nowhere. The ball, a different player had the ball, and he tackled a guy, and took him out. And Newcastle lodged an official complaint of the referee. He's just done it again. And so this is why, you know, so Manchester City are obviously cruising away, and the game, the result of the Chelsea-Liverpool game makes an even better weekend for them, because both of the rivals, I mean, so-called, both of the closest teams to them are dropping points. But, like, it does smooth the path a little bit when you get... you know, not just luck, but the decisions as well. And I say they got luck because, you know, even after they got that penalty, and I do think that the Man City penalty was a penalty. Mm. You know, it was an absolute Granit Xhaka special. You know, it's like Xhaka can never take, he can never take it when someone beats him. He never just accepts, okay, he's done me there, and now I've just got to turn around and hope that I don't turn around to see him smashing the ball into the net. Maybe I can get another block on it when I turn around. He goes, oh no, he's beaten me. No, I can't accept that. I'm going to both try to trip him and sort of pull out his shirt just in case the trip, you know. He's like, he goes to trip him, then he sort of pulls out of the trip. Then he just grabs it. I can't help but grab your shirt. And Bernardo Silva does dive. You can see him go, oh, there it is. You know, I've got the shirt pull. They'll see that. I better make sure that the ref sees it. And actually, the ref didn't give it. The ref didn't give either penalty in real time. But for some reason, they go back and say, well, look, this is clearly a foul on Bernardo Silva. When they didn't do it with, in my opinion, the more obvious Ederson foul. This is infuriating. You know, it's infuriating for everybody, really. Apart from Manchester City, whose path to another title is being smoothed by these decisions. You know, the look that I mentioned really was more to do with what Martinelli did just a couple of minutes after the penalty, where he just blazed wide of a completely, it's effectively an open goal. I mean, Nathan Ake is in the goal, but he's not going to be able to block if Martinelli can put the ball on target because he's in the goal. And Martinelli just manages to put it wide. Having had a sensational game, you know, I mean, he had so many amazing moments. I mean, there was one where the run where, you know, over 60 yards, he managed to sort of weave his way between both, Diaz and Cancelo, before eventually just getting around the back of Cancelo against him, knocking the ball wide.
Cancelo, yeah.
It was brilliant. Yeah. And then he misses it, and then almost immediately Arsenal had this red card, and this is one of the great Arsenal implosions. And weirdly, you know, Arsenal still afterwards, I think we're probably feeling pretty proud of themselves, just because they for you know, the first time in a long time managed to really put it up to Man City and actually outplay them certainly for most of the first half and have City in real trouble. And then have the feeling that we've only lost this because of the ref. You know what I mean? Although they did, in the end, lose it.
See, there is great comfort to be had in being able to come off and say, oh, well, we've been completely robbed here, you know? Even though the sending off was completely justified, the penalty they gave away was completely justified. And, well, listen, we've discussed the penalty. And you know, I mean, it's a penalty that they could have gotten, you know, in the first half. Like, who's to say that City don't come back and win the game in any case? You know, like, when the game was there to be won, they still couldn't do it. And then they have, you know, Pep, which I actually think would annoy them. You know, I mean, you know, there would be a subset of Arsenal fans who'd be really happy to hear Pep say, listen, you know, we were not the better team. But it's actually infuriating to a large section of Arsenal fans also, I would presume.
I mean, I can't say,
they were better. They were better.
Managers seldom say that when their team loses, you know, but it's easy to say, you know, the best team lost. I mean, even Mourinho says it's quite fun of that. The best team lost sometimes when his team has won a game. But, it's... I mean,
it was kind of done even before this weekend, but just the events of this weekend have just led, I think, everyone has just said, right, okay, well... Arsenal, Spurs, Manchester United will be a more for all the talk of a three-way title race, it'll be another three-way battle for fourth, which will be engaging most of our minds for the next 4 or 5 months. I mean, like, it is daft that you're as Graham Sooner is saying, listen, it's January 2nd, but even now, if you add up the total number of points that Chelsea and Liverpool get, if they win literally every single one of their games from now until the end of the season, do you still think City will get fewer points than that? I don't think so.
Probably not.
And that's presuming they win every single one of their games, which they're not going to.
I mean, the we'll know pretty soon, because the next game is Chelsea against Man City. The next Premier League game. I mean, there's Carabao Cup and FA Cup and whatnot, but the next Premier League game is Chelsea City. So if Chelsea win that, then it means there's still the sort of faintest chance that maybe City won't get there. But even then, they'd be so far ahead that you would still fancy them. But, you know, if Chelsea do win, then maybe, you know, as
the league begins in New Year's. Just get through the Christmas. The league begins on January 1st, as Sir Alex Ferguson used to say, when literally everything was different.
I saw, for instance, over the weekend, like Simon Wojcowski, who's a writer for the Manchester Evening News, making the point, because this has become a sort of, like, a couple of people were contacting us, sort of complaining about, you know, we were talking to Rory Smith about the kind of, you know, Rory's point was, I think it's unfortunate that you're at a point where a couple of draws in December means you're out of the title race. Mm. You know, you can't recover from that, and it does sort of take away a bit of the drama. And naturally, this sort of is irritating to City fans. It's like, well, it seems like people only complain about football being ruined when it's our team running away with it. When it's not as hardly as Man City have been the only team to do this over the years. Liverpool did it a couple of seasons ago. There's, you know, Chelsea did it a couple of seasons before that. You know, Manchester United have done it in the past. And it wasn't as though everyone was saying, "Meh, it may be ruined." And Simon Bukowski, his tweet was, well, he said, after 20 matches, Chelsea's points per game puts them on course to get 80 points this season. And that, of course, would have gone down since they only got 1 out of 3 points yesterday. That would have been enough to win 0 of the last 20 years. 0. 20. Liverpool are on course to get 82 points, enough to win 2 of the last 20 titles. So, and those two titles would have been 2011, when actually Man United, I think Man United who won it got 82 points that season. I think it would be goal difference. And Leicester in 2016 got, I think, 81. Liverpool, with what they're tracking for. So anyone asking how Liverpool and Chelsea can compete with City should be asking why these two clubs, with all of their resources, are tracking lower than basically every champion in the last 20 years. Spoiler, the answers can't be found at the Etihad. And so his point essentially is, it's not that City are so great, it's that the chasing pack are so mediocre. You know, these guys are jokers. You know, they wouldn't have been champions for the last, you know, the only thing that's changed here is no one's putting it up to, no one's actually putting it up to City.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that suggests that every club that's won the championship doesn't have a wobble in mid-season and then goes on to, you know what I mean? You take into account the wobble, but then you don't say, well, the fact that you've had a dip for 4 or 5 games means that in 10 more games you'll have another dip of 4 to 5 games. The whole idea of it is that, you know, you can have a wobble and then you recover, you greatly increase your points per game average over the second half of the season, and that's enough to then go on and win the idea is that you don't start at a pace that's a championship pace. The idea that you can dawdle along for a couple of months, and then, as Ferguson used to say, on January 1st, you go on a run, you win 8 in a row or something, and then you draw a couple of more games, and then you win another 6 or 7 in a row, and that's how you win the league. The idea is that you've had the wobble, and now it's dead. It's finished. It's over. That's like, I don't think that necessarily proves the point that the journalist there thinks he's making.
No, I don't think so either. And, you know, the fact is that this is taken just after both Chelsea and Liverpool have had their sort of wobble. So the points per game tracking looks a little lower than it actually would have otherwise. But it's also failing, I think, to emphasize the more significant point, which is that Manchester City are on course for 95 points this season. He does mention this based on the first 20 matches. And that, of course, would have gone up as they once again won the game against Arsenal. And he says, despite having failed to replace Sergio Aguero and also spent £100 million on a player who has been one of their most underwhelming performers. Despite having spent £100 million on a player who's basically been no good. Right? Despite just strikes me as the wrong. You know, like they can spend $100 million on a player and he doesn't even have to succeed and it will be fine. They just go on. Like, that's how powerful this team is. 95 points that they're tracking for, that would have won the league in every single season in history apart from 2018 when Man City won the league, 2019 when Man City won the league, and 2020 when Liverpool won the league. With the insane points total of 99. So every other season, what City are doing would have been would have been enough to be the champions. I think that's kind of the point. That's the sort of, that's the kind of freakish element here. You know, this the standard is like is so high that, you know, in a different world, these chasing teams, despite their disappointing, you know, effectively they've both kind of collapsed over Christmas. You know, I mean, they're both is Liverpool winless in four now. Chelsea have drawn 4 out of 5, so that's enough to really kick
five of their last six home games, I think, have been drawn as well.
Yeah, so that's really, you're stalling there, but they could still, you know, in normal circumstances, you know, what we're used to describe as normal circumstances, they could still feel as though we still have a chance here. You know, all is not lost, but now they kind of feel it's lost. But of course, if they believe it is, then it definitely will be. Where were we? I mean, that game, Chelsea obviously spent 100 million on a player who hasn't performed for them. We're going to be talking a bit more about that with Raphael Hornstein soon. But they actually do need players who they spend their money on. They still are in a position of needing their record signings to perform, and it hurts them if that doesn't happen. I mean, would he have been any use in that game yesterday? I don't know. Maybe it would have been helpful to be able to throw him on at the end, because I feel as though, you know, the second half was quite different from the first. I mean, both because the teams were thinking it would be terrible to lose this now after everything that's gone into it, but mainly because I think they were both really tired and couldn't keep up the tempo of before. I mean, Liverpool in particular struck me as very defensive compared to their usual attitude in these games. I think really in the last sort of quarter of the game, they very much said a draw is the best we can do here, and weren't really even sort of trying to come out, which is not typical with them. But I think when you look at it hasn't been typical for them over the last few years. But I think when you look at who they actually had in the field, the sort of tiredness that was obvious from guys like Henderson, you know, Fabinho, they just aren't able to kind of take a grip on games that the way they used to be. Not for the entire game. They can still do it for like a half, but you know,
I think it was, like there was definitely a moment in the first half where it was extraordinary that Liverpool were 2-0 up, because it really felt like they had barely played. And you know, Salah's goal was just so unbelievably good. Like, you know, there's no defending it. There's no stopping that.
Someone could have noticed them making the run. I mean, you know, Chelsea were a bit too, I mean, Chelsea obviously are being compact, but they were just a bit too compact. And everybody, you know, took their eye off Salah, and he realized that nobody's watching me here. I can just run behind their entire team. You know, it was very unusual. I mean, to see a run from there end up where he did with nobody really getting close to him.
Yeah, the ball over is so good though, and the first touch is so good. I mean, you know, I think there are probably 20 or 30 moments in a game like that where, you know, where that's available if you can deliver the pass and you can have a first touch as good as that. And it's just, you know, like the quality of Joel was just so unbelievably good that I think it's nearly churlish to be talking about, you know, a defensive lapse. But yeah, I mean, for all that, Chelsea did. They probably did deserve to win at halftime level, given that they had been brilliant for 25 minutes and were a goal down after all of that.
Yeah, I fancied them to win the game, to be honest. And then, I mean, they nearly did. I mean, they nearly scored like 3 goals in 5 minutes before halftime. It was a Mason Mount one. I mean, Mount, this was the one that went just wide of the post.
Keller had it covered. I maintain that
Keller
had a good.
Keller made a couple of great saves. Whatever about Van Dijk leaving unsaid what he might have done with the second goal, he did make a brilliant save from Pulisic. Kind of an Alisson type save. Alisson is good at that, you know, tackling a forward with his hands, sort of punching the ball away. I've seen him do that a couple of times. And it's obviously something Keller has kind of incorporated his game as well, because it was brilliant, a brilliant challenge on Pulisic, and then to when he could easily give away a penalty, and then a close range save again from the same player in the second half. The Mount one is going wide, but all Mount really needs to do is just take that one down. I mean, I lecture Mason Mount on this from my chair. Really, all you needed to do there was take
what
a touch.
He should have done. Yeah.
and it would have been a pretty easy finish. Well, he still would have had to beat Gallagher, of course. Mm. You must have been delighted to see Brighton winning again. Two wins
well,
and three.
Unbelievably,
now.
I have a few Brighton fans sending me like snotty messages on Twitter.
Really? Like, what are they saying?
Ah, just, you know, that I was a prick and stuff like that, Ken. Listen, it's no big deal. No one called me a prick, but people are just helpfully pointing out that their XG, that they're finally cashing in on their unbelievable XG performance. Where can I find the tweet here? Yes, apparently that's what they're doing. Anyway, all of their hard work is paying dividends now. They're reaping what they sowed in the XG.
Ironically, they didn't win the XG against Everton.
It doesn't get any more ironic than that, Ken.
I don't know if it is ironic, but it was it was certainly unfortunate for Everton, who again. Well, not again. They don't often do it, but they won the XG and lost 3-2. One of the most tense penalties I've ever seen taken by Calvert-Lewin. I've never seen a player radiate such an impression of like coiled sort of nerves and tension. I mean, it's such a strange penalty taken. Do you remember the what he did? Mm. I mean, puts the ball down, and then he sort of. He stood really close to the ball and then suddenly like leapt forward and lashed at it and lashed it over the bar or off the top of the bar. Mm. And I just thought that was not what I would like to. It's not my idea of a good penalty technique. They did at least have little Gordon, who was the same age as Adam Ida, for instance, scoring a couple of goals, which is a bright spot. But obviously it looks as though maybe Richard Keyes was right and Rafa's in deep trouble.
What are you saying?
You're just a phony, man. This is just what
I admit I don't look like the athlete of the day. Supposed to look.
This ain't wrestling. This ain't the WWE, baby.
My belly's just a little big. My hand is just a little big.
This is just an act that you're doing. You should be an actor.
But brother, I am bad and they know I'm bad.
I'll never do that.
There were two bad people. One was John Wayne and he's dead, brother. And the other was right here.
You can run around like you a preacher and all that you want, but baby, I promise you, I will baptize you. I don't play this, man.
You can't teach that.
Well, it's great to start the new year by talking to one of our favorite contributors, Raphael Honigstein, joins us now. How are you doing, Raphael?
I'm fine, Ken. How are you?
Very well. I wanted to ask you what you made of this whole drama, which has blown up to, I believe, incredible proportions over the last few days involving Thomas Tuchel, Romelu Lukaku. I mean, Tuchel said before the game, actually, he said this just got too noisy. What do you think it was that annoyed him so much about this interview?
It's hard to say, really, because he was at pains of pointing out after the game that it was nothing personal, that he didn't feel attacked. I don't think it was the passage where Lukaku seems to be questioning Tuchel's methods or his system that really riled him. I think it's the wider point whereby Lukaku seemed to suggest that he's there at Chelsea, but actually he'd rather be somewhere else. Either at Inter or Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern, these are teams that he'd thought about. And that seems to be the section that has riled both the Chelsea hierarchy and, if Tuchel is to be believed, also at least upset the important players in the dressing room enough for them to suggest, well, maybe it is a good idea. He said he consulted with them. They said it was a big topic in the dressing room. And he obviously felt that he needed to make that move. It's still, as you suggest, I think there's still a gap between the size of the misdemeanor and the result or the consequence. And it does feel almost like an overreaction. And it'd be very interesting to see what happens in this meeting today, because even now, or even last night, they were suggesting, well, who knows what's going to happen, as if, you know, Lukaku might be sentenced to 3 months in jail. Or it was very, very sort of ominous. You know, we're having this big meeting and who knows what's going to happen. So I think reading between the lines, you can only surmise, I think, that what Lukaku has done fits into a wider pattern whereby the club and Tuchel and maybe even some of the players feel that he's not fully committed to them. That's the only explanation I have, that this is not sort of just one big moment, but actually in the eyes of the people responsible, more sort of a culmination or continuation of him being a little bit not fully bought in. And that's, and I'm speculating here, but that's the only explanation I can find for the reaction being this strong.
What about the explanation that Lukaku is a flop and someone's got to take the fall for that? Lukaku was pointing the finger at his coach saying, well, you know, he's decided to go to a different system and, you know, obviously I'm not happy. But, you know, he was suggesting that it's Tuchel's fault that I can't score any goals.
I'm not sure he did. There was a suggestion that he slightly misspoke when he said modulo then. Instead of formation or system, he wanted to say just methods. And that would have been a lot softer. You know, a new coach, new ideas. I'm still getting used to it. I can make it work. And that was it. Of course, you always question the player bringing these things up in the first place. Why just not keep quiet? But the interview happened at a time when he was perhaps a little bit frustrated. He'd just come back, scored a couple of goals. You know, he was being important. I don't think he is a flop. But let's put it this way. The amount of a fallout or the degree of the fallout would suggest that in the eyes of Chelsea and at least Tuchel, he's perhaps not as important as he should be.
Sorry, and your sense is that they are as one at that. Both Tuchel and the board, or the club officials who signed Lukaku, because I'm not sure that Thomas Tuchel necessarily took the initiative in signing this player.
He might have not taken the initiative, but I think he was, and this I know this from people who are fairly close to him, I think he was quite happy with having a centre-forward. He wanted a centre-forward. There weren't a tons of, you know, outstanding centre-forwards around. Lukaku had just had one of his best seasons, perhaps his best ever season at Inter. He was available. And I think Tuchel was quite happy, as you would be, because he adds something that Chelsea haven't got. And I think there's still a role for him to play. I don't think he's been particularly bad. I think he's had injuries, he's had COVID, his game time has been limited, but I don't think it's necessarily through him being playing badly. So I don't think this is terminal. I mean, what's going to be interesting now is what kind of happens next, because the board and Tuchel might be, and the team might be in full agreement of what happened now, you know, take him out of the game, give him a bit of breathing space, make him come back saying maybe, you know, got things wrong, let's start again. If this persists, however, if somehow this is an expression of Lukaku trying really to get out of Chelsea, as the brother of the journalist suggested who did the interview, interesting definition of off record, by the way.
It's unbelievable.
Then I think we have an issue, because then you have an asset, the most expensive player that Chelsea have ever bought, and you have a coach and perhaps a team that think he's not quite good enough. And then it's a big question of what happens next. And in the past, Tuchel has been very, very forceful with players that he, for whatever reason, doesn't like. He's been very, very strong and almost ostracizing them. I'm not suggesting this might necessarily repeat itself, but at Dortmund, that was definitely a situation where it didn't matter how big the name was. If Tuchel didn't fancy you, you had a really hard time. And this is when I think we might see that unity somehow crumbling a little bit, because essentially you start then damaging your asset to a certain extent. So that's going to be really interesting.
Can you think of or tell us about any previous examples of that in terms of falling out with players? I mean, he did while he was a PSG deal, I suppose, but with a lot of players who were, let's say, somewhat willful. I can't remember him having any major fallouts. Maybe just my memory isn't that good. Maybe your memory is better.
At PSG, I think it wasn't so much him and players, although there were one or two situations, but I guess they're inevitable with the type of players you have at PSG. It was him and the sporting director, of course, Leonardo, which was the big problem. But he had actually learned, I think, from his experience at Dortmund, where he didn't have a strong connection to some of the important players, and changed his coaching team to have a slightly more emotional bond. And Charles Löw, who's come in, I think helped him a lot with PSG and helps him a lot at Chelsea. But at Dortmund, there were players like Mats Hummels, you know, the captain or de facto captain, Levan Subotic, sort of a real club icon, a few others who didn't appreciate the way Tuchel spoke to people, didn't appreciate the times that Tuchel ostracized one or two players, make them really suffer if he felt that they weren't playing enough. They spoke out and they were punished for it. It came to a, not to a head, but to give you an example, Levan Subotic, as I said, you know, huge, huge player internally and for the fans. He wasn't put in the squad for the Cup final in 2016. And what Tuchel then did is actually tell him, you can't visit the hotel, the team hotel before the final. You're banned from the team hotel, which was really seen as excessive. I mean, it's just a small thing, but it spoke to a very combustible, almost vindictive nature that Tuchel had at the time. And I don't think we've reached that point yet at all with Lukaku. He didn't seem to be suggesting that in his fairly relaxed demeanor after the game last night. But it shows you that once you fall on the wrong side of Tuchel, then it often gets very difficult.
What is your sense of what Lukaku was trying to achieve with the interview?
Well, I think there are two possibilities. One is, as the brother of the journalist involved suggested, he really wants out. And this is the first step towards trying to find a way out. If you want to extricate yourself from a situation like that, you have to probably do it with an amount of publicity, because otherwise people not understand what it is you're doing. You've only been here for a few months. That's one possibility. The other possibility, which I think I prefer at this moment, or I find more realistic, is that he tried to just write a bit of a love letter to the Inter fans, and just got a little bit lost. Started talking, started being a little bit too open, a bit too emotional, and said a lot of things that he shouldn't have said. I think that is the more realistic possibility, because from what I understand, his agents were not aware that this was going to happen. The club certainly were not aware, so this was completely him doing this. And I think if this was a bigger move, not the first possibility, I'd be surprised if he'd done that without anyone knowing, if indeed they didn't know. But I think it's fairly obvious that they weren't informed. So I'd like to think that he just basically got a little bit lost in his own emotions and started saying things that reflected well on his time at Inter, but he didn't think through how they would be perceived at his current club. And I think if that is true, then there should be a fairly easy way back. But of course, that also is with the proviso that everything else is fine, that he actually fits into the team, etc., which maybe, judging from the Chelsea reaction, isn't quite... maybe he's not quite as appreciated as he thinks he is. Otherwise, I think they wouldn't have dropped him that easily.
I mean, one thing in his favour is that they did sign him because they needed a player in that position. And it's not as though, when you look at Chelsea's team at the moment, there are obvious players who should be playing there instead of him. And the guy who they were using, I guess, in Lukaku's position, or in the closest thing to Lukaku's position yesterday, was Kai Havertz, who also has struggled a little bit. I think it's fair to say, Rafael. I mean, maybe not as badly as Timo Werner. It's not as though Kai Havertz hasn't had some great moments already in a Chelsea shirt, but there haven't been too many of them. I mean, he seems like a player who's good at almost everything apart from scoring or assisting goals, which are pretty important when you're at the focal point of your team's attack.
I don't think it's that. I don't think he is made to be a centre forward in the Premier League playing the way that Chelsea play. I've always felt that Chelsea, even under Tuchel, there's a directness to them. It's a little bit wild and loose at times. And if you are the target man, the centre forward, playing with your back to goal, I think it's not his game. If Chelsea had a bit more possession, play a bit slower, He can drop deep, can really do his stuff. He's a number 10 playing as a number 9, in my view. Then I think we'd see a very different Kai Havertz. So I think it's a little bit the result of the system, of the way that the Chelsea play, of the way that the Premier League work when Chelsea play. And of course, there's also still a process of adjustment. I think he has bulked up. I think he's become strong on the ball. But he still doesn't look 100% at home. I think that's absolutely right.
I'm shocked by what you're saying about the how it's difficult for a player like him to fit into the way Chelsea are trying to play. It's evidently been difficult for Lukaku. It's been difficult for Werner. Is there anyone this might actually suit, or is this a system that necessarily makes forward players look bad?
No, I don't think it makes forward players look bad. I don't think Lukaku has looked bad when he was...
You don't think so? I mean, we definitely disagree about this, because Lukaku, over his couple of years in Inter, was a really... was a prolific goal scorer who, you know, looked great. I mean, he's playing an empty stadium in Serie A. I mean, it seems to me to be the main difference between what, you know, he was great at that. And this is, you know, he's been replaced by Edin Dzeko, who... Apparently, a lot of Inter fans are saying, well, you know, Dzeko is actually almost even better than Lukaku. You know, Dzeko was a good striker in the Premier League 10 years ago. Like, is this a pace of football that he's just not really suited to play?
I don't think that's the problem, but I think there's a problem if there's a lack of control. And I think this Chelsea team are still trying to figure out how they have more control in games. I think Tuchel would be the first one to admit that. I don't think Lukaku has been... playing badly. I think 5 goals in 13.
He's had 7 shots on target, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter because he's not going to get many touches. I think if he takes shots from decent positions, if he scores 5 out of 7 shots, that's fine. Yes, of course, you want them to be more involved. But how many games has he played? I think, you know, 13 games. I think that's far too early to make any definitive judgment whether he fits in or not. Especially when you see how new players have struggled. I mean, look, let's talk about Kovacic or Jorginho. Where were they after 13 games in the Chelsea team? They were nowhere. And certainly with Jorginho, I mean, there was a real campaign to sort of get him out of the club almost. I think it's a bit harsh to say he doesn't fit in, it doesn't work for him, the Premier League's not for him. He's not at his best, yes. He can play a lot better, yes. But Inter, there was a lot of counter-attacking, a lot of space for him to run to against Chelsea. A lot of teams don't push up. They play quite deep, and then it becomes more difficult for him in small spaces. I think one thing we can discuss is, and I think that's something that he said, this idea that he is a target man in the orthodox sense, that he's best holding up the ball and just knocking things on, this probably doesn't actually do him justice. Yes, he is big and tall and very strong, but actually his game is more about spaces, is more about linking up, is more about making runs. And all these things are very difficult when you play against very deep defenses who are aware of that. Maybe more so than they were in Italy, even though you'd think that they'd be clued up to that. But I think Serie A at this stage is quite open, and maybe there's actually more joy to be had for centre forwards.
I have to say it's a long time since I've seen a game as open as the one yesterday. I mean, is this what these German coaches are doing to the Premier League? Rafael just storming from end to end with almost no midfield at all. You must have been proud.
I was very proud and privileged of being there and seeing it. I mean, I think it was open in a sense that we saw lots of chances created, but you could see the teams trying to be organized. I think that, you know, Liverpool tried to be compact. It was just Chelsea took advantage of some mistakes. You know, they scored from a corner. They nearly scored from a mistaken clearance. Trying to think where the second goal came from.
The second Chelsea goal was Rudiger beating Salah to a ball and sort of knocking it forward. You know, I think Alexander-Arnold tried to pass to Salah, but Rudiger got there first.
Yeah, that was a case of Alexander-Arnold being out of position, and then the back three was disorganized. But maybe my judgment or my sort of experience is clouded by being there and by the sort of the rush and the excitement you felt. But some people on Twitter did suggest that this was actually a poor game because it was full of defensive mistakes and chaos, but it didn't feel like that to me. It felt like two really highly skilled, highly organized teams doing damage to each other the way that very few teams can. A little bit similar to Arsenal v City, where you can say, well, it was quite open because of the amount of chances that Arsenal create. But I think that was more testament to Arsenal playing well than to suddenly, you know, saying City is a team that cannot defend, which is definitely not true. And I think the same is not true of Chelsea or Liverpool. They look a lot more solid. I think you have to look at the good work of the attacking departments rather than blaming poor defending for the spectacle.
Do you think Liverpool looks solid? Because, you know, watching them yesterday, obviously Salah, I think I saw a statistic that he's the first player since Thierry Henry to have 25 goal involvements in a row, or rather 25 goal involvements for five seasons in a row. And he does kind of have that aura of, you know, Thierry Henry in 2004 at the moment, you know, in terms of his standing in the league. And Liverpool generally actually have that kind of late invincibles feel from, I find that kind of, they play lovely football and they've got that aging spine.
I don't see any similarities between Liverpool and Wenger's Arsenal.
What I was going there for was a side that's maybe lost a little bit of the steeliness that characterised them at their finest period.
I mean, when they won the league, they were defensively very, very sound, and they won games 1-0, 2-1. There was a degree of control, I think, that perhaps isn't quite there yet. Yes, I'd agree with that. I think it's to do with the amount of changes, the amount of times that the first 11, if you will, haven't been available. Every time there's a change, I think it seems to hurt Liverpool a little bit more than teams that perhaps are a bit more strong collectively down to number 15, 16, like Man City, I think is the best example. Maybe even Chelsea. But I think they've made up for that in being more productive going forward. I think if you look at the underlying numbers, they concede more chances, but they create more. So I don't think anything's changed. I think they are as good, you know, bottom line, as they were when they won the title, when perhaps even then they were only the second best team in the league. Again, looking at the underlying numbers, maybe City got a little bit unlucky that year and Liverpool maybe slightly overperformed. But I think they're an amazing side and they're good enough to win the league. It's just that City have been absolutely flawless. And how do you compete with somebody, with a team that's basically flawless? It's beyond this Liverpool side. And in the big games, they haven't won. There have been a lot of draws. And ultimately, that's what's going to cost them, I think. But no, I don't see in any way that they're sort of over the hill, or, you know, their forces are waning or anything. I think they're incredibly strong. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if they won the Champions League again this year.
Well, you mentioned City. They obviously are miles in front now, and, you know, there's been lots of complaints about, oh, you know, this isn't competitive, this isn't fun anymore, City are too good. which, okay, I mean, people have made various arguments about this, but I wondered, you know, in the big picture, does it strike you as though another Germanizing characteristic of the Premier League is that there's one team that sort of lords it over everybody else and that nobody can catch, and that Manchester City are becoming a kind of an English Bayern?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think City's financial situation does not put them in Bayern's role. Bayern are almost double the team or the club in terms of the income than the next best rivals, and then the multiple becomes bigger and bigger. With City, you can say, because of the way that the club is structured, etc., they have an advantage over a lot of these teams, maybe most of them, maybe all of them. But the advantage isn't clearly pronounced enough, in my view, in financial terms, to explain why they'd be dominating the league. I think it takes actually somebody like Pep Guardiola cracking the code of football and basically guaranteeing league wins. He's not so good in knockout games, which is an interesting discussion, but league games, churning out wins, he's figured out how to do that with sort of almost, yeah, a degree of inevitability. And he's figured it out in three different leagues now. I think Pep Guardiola leaves, I can't think of any coach that would come to mind where I would be confident saying that this will just continue because City as a team are so strong. I don't think that's the case. I think they're coached to this excellence, and I don't see necessarily all this money having translated into world-class players throughout. I think they're world-class players in this particular team. You take them out, I don't think they necessarily make the difference for many teams. Maybe Kevin De Bruyne, you know, being one exception, maybe Ruben Dias, but then there are a lot of players, you know, Riyad Mahrez, even Raheem Sterling. I don't see the biggest teams in the world clamoring for them saying, oh, it's unfair that, you know, City have these players, they dominate the league with these players. It's not that. It's the system and it's Pep. And I think that's ultimately why it will be a fleeting experience.
It's interesting, though, that when he left Bayern, there was an expectation. And in fact, there was a kind of a post-Guardiola wobble, you know, in terms of, you know, the Ancelotti thing didn't go well and he didn't last very long. And everyone was saying, oh, this place is kind of, we feel like there's been a slackening here and so on. But they sort of just kept very consistently getting similar points totals and winning the league anyway, as though they hadn't, whatever he told them, they hadn't forgotten. I mean, the same thing could happen again.
Yeah, but there was, as you said, there was a big, big drop off and they had a very poor season. And if Bayern don't react very decisively in September, remember they fired Ancelotti in September of the next season and put Jupankis in, who basically reinstalls the Guardiola blueprint with some of his own man management superimposed on it, I think then Bayern don't win the league. They got very close to not winning the league under Niko Kovac, 78 points. That's very low by Guardiola standards. Dortmund really, I think, should have pipped them that year. And then we might be having a different conversation about Bayern's dominance. And now Nagelsmann, they have somebody who's probably as good as, not Pep in his prime, but somebody who's going to be, I think, one of the best coaches in the world in years to come. So then it's very difficult for anyone else. If you have coaching excellence plus by far the best team, then it's hard not to dominate. But Bayern have shown that you can actually mess it up. And I think that is the lesson. I think it's very easy to look at outcomes and say they're somehow inevitable. But you look at plenty of big teams, and I can think of many, who spend as much money relative to, you know, to their own leagues or in absolute terms, and the outcome is far less impressive than City under Pep. So I think that tells you that it's not quite that straightforward, a connection between the money and the success.
Okay. Well, Raphael Hoeneß-Steyn, it's been great having you back on the show today, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Ask Gary if he thinks like the publicity he's given young Frank here warrants it, because personally I don't think he's quite good enough yet. And I also think that in the last couple of years you've let some good midfielders go for peanuts, like Matt Holland and Scott Canham.
Well, no, they definitely wasn't good enough. I'll tell you now, you know, you can sit in front of all these people, I'll tell you, without any shadow of a doubt, there will be no comparison with what Frank Lampard will achieve in football and what Scotty Cannon will achieve in football. And I may be now, I didn't want to say this in front of him, but he will go right to the very top. Right to the very top.
Well, there you are. You heard it here first.
He has given them belief. It's almost a perfect man management.
I love this club. When we start the season wanting to win,
I'm convinced Frank Lampard will become England manager.
Frank Lampard's lost 8 games.
Well, I can't drag people out of the medical room.
But for some reason, hey, Frank's doing all right. Frank, maybe because he's English. I don't know.
Why do you think you were off the pace today?
I know, that's one for the players.
I'd love Frank Lampard to get the Chelsea job in 10 years' time.
Frank's track record on CV went to Derby, didn't get promoted. But Frank's got all the answers for Chelsea. He hasn't.
I think for a journalist to be objective would be a big start.
Harry Redknapp joins us live this morning. Harry, good morning to you.
Good morning. People need time. You lose 4 or 5 games, it doesn't suddenly make you a bad manager. You're only as good as your players at the end of the day. And the players that are brought in, the two German players, have been massive disappointments.
Yeah.
Massive. I've not yet seen a manager that can turn very average players into great players. I'm still looking to see somebody who can do that.
You heard it here first.
Can I, and I tell you now, there ain't no doubt about that, in my opinion.
Are you taking the Christmas tree down today, Ken?
I usually leave it till the 6th.
Me too, man.
I just
December 1st to January 6th in our house.
Yeah.
Feck it, like.
No, I will leave it to the sixth. Just because I've no great urge to tackle it today.
I'm with you, man.
We'll get rid of it at some point.
just out the front door, isn't it?
No,
they
I have a fake one.
Oh, okay.
I don't want the dog marking it. He's got no interest. He doesn't recognize it as a tree. But if it's a real one, it's different.
It's true. I should also say well done to you, Kev, because when I first heard from you this morning, I thought that you sounded maybe a little fatigued, but your performance levels over the last hour, I've hinted at no such tiredness. Was I mistaken? Was there some reason for your lethargy?
I think it was just I hadn't spoken in a couple of hours when I spoke to you, so it just sounded as though, you know, like a whale
trying to
talk.
Come on, Ken, tell the people. You were up till 2:30 watching darts, weren't you?
Well, that is true. I was up watching the darts rerun. Why was I doing that? I mean, eventually I said, why am I doing this? Like, I've got to get up quite early, and I'm watching darts. But, like, it is actually difficult to stop watching darts once you start watching darts.
Mm.
You know? Even though I don't care about the athletes. Smith versus Wade. You know, it sounds like a court case. But actually, it was a darts World Championship semifinal. Smith won in the end. Yeah. But I think I eventually looked up that result. Because I was like, I've got to go to bed. Who won this game? And... And yeah, it was Smith, who I believe is one of the finalists.
Yeah, it's weird. Like I obviously have a Twitter just full of people saying unbelievable darts. This is unbelievable. God, could this be the greatest darts game of all time? And that's all I've been reading for the last week or so.
Mm.
And I just have this really weird relationship with the darts. I mean, it's not like I just don't watch it. You know, I don't have any disdain for it. I don't have any contempt for it. I don't have any reason in the world not to watch it, other than that I have enough sport in my life, you know?
Yeah.
Well, why, at this juncture, try and get involved in the darts?
That's why I don't watch most sport.
You're absolutely right. Why would I want to get involved yet more emotionally with just, you know, another sport that, you know, I've done well to avoid it now. I just feel, it's like smoking, you know? I've done well to avoid smoking now. Why would I want to get involved with something that is just going to, you know, diminish the quality of my life for no reason? So to all of you darts fans out there, I wish you all the best. I mean, it's an unbelievably exciting time in your lives. It's great, but I just haven't done it yet. But I mean, I will say this, it wouldn't be the World Championship of Darts if Mark Horgan wasn't sending me extremely foul-mouthed Dutch TV darts coverage. This clip from the Darts Anonymous Twitter account is of Ted the Count Hanky with some helpful self-talk while on the way to blowing a checkout of just 25.
I fancy double 12 or double 8. Who's in charge? Me or the devil? I think I'm in charge. Fuck, down double eight, shake his hand. Just like that. Come on, you cunt. Fucking cunt.
Who's in charge? I think I'm in charge. Mrs. Double Eight loses the leg. Who cares? It's the sport of kings, Ken. It really is. I love it to the extent that I love watching... I love watching 25 to 30 second YouTube clips. 25 to 30 second YouTube clips that Mark Horgan sends on to me from time to time. Anyway, we love tons of football, a brand new Ken Early Politics podcast, and rugby on the World Service this week. So why not join up now for a fiver a month plus VAT? Go to secondcaptains.com. It seems like the right time to join, don't you think? Oh, McDevitt will be back tomorrow morning. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kieran.
And we'll chat to you tomorrow.
I lost.
Yeah.
Fuck's sake, I don't want to lose it.
They shouldn't interview you now.
And I'm fucked up.
Oh, fine shit.
You get me in 10 minutes, I'll be alright. They shouldn't interview you now.
So I better go to go now. Or first I have some coaching questions.
It's too late now. What's that? Are you interviewing me or not? Seriously. Come on.
Is there an explanation for this? Is there an explanation for this?
You could be my mama and I'll be your boy.
Original road boy, never my coy.
We know you as a very good dart player.
I'm not playing shit.
Fuck's sake, I don't want losing.
But is there an explanation for that, or?
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not.
How do you prepare for the last match then?
These are the questions that you should be asking when we're live.
So we're live now.
We're not live now.
Yeah, we're live. There you are on television. I'm serious. Yeah.
What was it on top?
Sorry?
Should have been told. Oh, I thought you know. Well, I'll prepare to say, if I win, I win. But I cannot keep playing like this. This is no good.
It's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.